Napa know-how.
A Napa guy knows the only way you'd give a fresh and minted driver a brand new car is if he promises to never drive it. Instead, let him grind the gears and knock over the neighbor's mailbox in something a little more suited to his skill level. And with over 500,000 parts and a little Napa know-how, he can safely drive something that's nearly as old as he is. It's not perfect, but it's perfect for him. That's Napa know-how.
Napa know-how.
In this short solo pod, I begin by talking about the old but very interesting Cavs-Portland trade. Then I update my tier rankings and spend most of my time there, and then end on a few thoughts about how the lottery balls are shaping up. Of course, you're listening to Ode to Odin, the NBA Draft Podcast. Welcome back, guys, to Ode to Odin, the NBA Draft Podcast. I'm Sean Darenthal, your host. Really happy to have you on for this episode. I've had so many great guests recently that I haven't had time to do a solo pod where I update my tier rankings. If you're not super familiar with the podcast because you've joined us since we've moved to the Almighty Baller Podcast Network, I'll fill you in on how I do things here. But first, let's start off with some news. This is really old news, but I still think it's very interesting, so we should go over it. Of course, this podcast is all about the NBA draft, and I swear to talk about all things NBA draft. Every trade that has a draft pick, every pick protection, every swap, everything of that nature. And I never got to the Kyle Korver trade, which was kind of the only big trade of the season and was the big news at that time, which involved a draft pick. So, of course, I've got to talk about it. Cleveland gave up their 2019 first rounder to Atlanta, which is top 10 protected for a couple years. And if it doesn't convey, then it's turned into 2 second rounders. But the far more interesting trade, especially from a draft pick trade perspective, was the trade prior to the Korver trade. And we can learn a ton from it between the Cavs and the Blazers. So all the way back, if you can cast your minds that far, in early January, if you can imagine that David Griffin, the Cavs general manager, is talking to Mike Budenholzer and Wes Wilcox, the coach president and GM of the Hawks, respectively. And they're discussing this Korver trade that's about to go down. And they're getting a little bit hung up. Atlanta is on waiting 3 years for the Cavs' next available first rounder. I imagine the Cavs are probably offering their 2020 first round pick, which was the earliest that they could trade because they owed their 2018 pick to Portland. So you can kind of just imagine this conversation. Bud or Wes Wilcox is saying, you know, David, this trade looks good, but you know, that pick's so far away. We want some more immediate value. Isn't there any way that we can get a sooner first round pick from you guys? And Griffin, you know, says, well, I've been using our first round picks like fruit baskets to try and get some good deals done over the past couple years. We're all lucked up to Portland for 2018, which means we can't trade the 2017 pick because of the Stepien rule. Oh, Bud, what's that? You don't know what that is? You know, the one that says you can't trade picks for two consecutive years. And then Atlanta is about to say no to the deal. Maybe, I don't know, that's a little too far away. Can't you do anything? Maybe give us another player or something. Then Griffin says, okay, hold on 1 second. Let me go call Portland, see what I can do. So David Griffin gets on the phone with Neil O'Shea and says, hey, Neil, what do you think about trading us back our 2018 pick for our current 2017 pick, unfreaking protected? Obviously, Neil says yes 1,000 times over. Yes, please. That's a no-brainer. Cleveland will be good for the next few years. Why not get it sooner rather than later, especially in a draft that I think is so deep at the top that it could push down a few valuable role player types that normally go in the early 20s down to those last five picks or so. Some of you at this point, like me, the very first time I heard about this trade, are like, whoa, why can Cleveland now trade the 2017 pick? You just mentioned the Stepien rule about not trading consecutive first rounders, and they definitely didn't have one last year, so they can't trade this one, right? Well, it turns out that the Stepien rule says nothing about preceding years or years that are before, you know, the current year. So a team can actually trade away its current first rounder every single year if it wants. It just has to be in that year of that draft, if that makes sense. They just can't trade future picks in consecutive years. So anyway, Griffin comes back to Atlanta, says, hey, Wes, hey, Bud, I've got the ability to trade you now, my 2019 pick. So, you know, now can the deal go through? Can we have Korver? And the deal obviously is eventually done. So you can see that there are a few interesting moving parts here as far as draft pick trades are concerned. That detail about the Stepien rule and Griffin's kind of forethought to go back and switch his pick with Portland for next year's pick instead of this year's pick, or rather for this year's pick instead of next year's pick. Also, on a kind of interesting note, and this is me just spitballing here, but I insinuated earlier that David Griffin's motives for wanting to trade a 2019 to Atlanta instead of the 2020 first rounder was because Atlanta wanted to make the deal happen, because Atlanta wanted that extra value by getting the sooner pick. But I wonder if the motive was actually opposite. I wonder if that Cleveland first rounder in 2020 wouldn't be more valuable than its first rounder in 2019. We usually peg GMs for being kind of short-sighted, at least a little, because they would just want to keep their jobs. But what if for Griffin the motives were kind of opposite? What if he was looking long-term? What if he didn't want to give up the pick that could potentially be really important to a Cleveland rebuild in the year 2020? At the time of the 2020 season, LeBron will be 35. He'll probably get that supermax from the new CBA, so he'll probably be locked in at that point, but who knows where his health will be. 35 is pretty old. I know it's LeBron and he never breaks. He's an alien. So, you know, maybe he'll just be LeBron, just, you know, a few steps lesser than he is now. But who knows, right? There is some uncertainty there. Also, more of the uncertainty, I think, might lie with Kyrie's health, whether Kevin Love is still even on the team by then. We'll probably never know the exact motives, but I'd be really interested to know what David Griffin was thinking there and which pick he values more, the 2019 or 2020 pick. Okay, so let's get to the main topic here, the meat of the podcast. I am going to release my new tier rankings. If you are just now listening to the podcast, or maybe you've caught us over the last few episodes and you haven't gone back to the very beginning where I explained how I like to rank players, I don't do it by just the normal board where you rank them 1 through 100 or 1 through 25 or whatever it is. I think that you miss a lot of nuance doing it that way. And I also think that just drafting best player available probably is too simplistic of a strategy, although generally it seems pretty good. I think grouping players in tiers, especially for evaluating them early on and going forward, is the best way to do it. It's better at distinguishing the gaps between players. Like right now, spoiler, Markelle Fultz is in tier one all by himself. And I think there's a pretty sizable gap between him and the next player, whoever you think that might be. So if you do it by tier system, you know, that nuance can kind of be explained, I think, a little bit better. You can understand where the large gaps are between talent. I think when you're trying to understand the value of a draft slot, having a good idea of a tier is really important, because the guy obviously at the bottom of that tier is going to be a lot more valuable than just the next pick right after him, because, you know, there's a large gap in talent that you won't have access to in that higher tier. And also, just a few notes, I try to stay really conservative with this at the beginning of the season and going on through. And then after the season, or maybe during the playoffs, as I'm prepping for the draft and I get to watch a lot more video, then I start to whittle down these tiers and break them down into, you know, smaller and smaller chunks where I feel really comfortable with it. But I think if anyone's telling you that they know for certain after like pick 10 or maybe after pick 8, or, you know, especially anyone telling you that they know the difference between two players side by side after pick 15, I think is pretty crazy and doesn't understand the uncertainty that's involved in the draft. So even having chunks of 10 players past, I think, pick 15 is probably just maybe an admission of how difficult it is to draft and how difficult it is to project players. Anyway, so also within these tiers, the players that I named, the order in which I named these players has absolutely no meaning. They're in alphabetical order. If I haven't ranked them yet and they're in the same tier together, that means I don't feel strongly enough to be able to separate them, although I probably have some feeling so far. I want to be a little bit conservative and let things kind of play out. Also, Harry Giles, he's going to be in my tier 7, the last tier that I actually rank, and only because clearly I think he has a lot more potential than he's shown this season, even though I wasn't necessarily super, super high on him coming into the draft, although I did have him in my tier 1 because of a lot of guys that I trusted had him in their tier 1. I think that he's a lot better than he's shown so far, so take his ranking with a grain of salt. All right, so that's enough prep. You probably don't care about that. And so let's just get right into it. Oh, wait, actually, before, let me say one last thing. You probably want to know where my preseason rankings were, which were the last rankings that I did before this update. So just a little primer. You can see how these guys have shifted in my mind and maybe where I messed up or maybe where I got some things right preseason. In my first tier, I had Markelle Fultz, Harry Giles, and Jason Tatum. My second tier, I had Josh Jackson, Frank Ntilikina, Dennis Smith Jr. In my third tier, I had Lonzo Ball, De'Aaron Fox. And then my fourth tier, I had everyone else. My last tier is a catch-all tier, where maybe I haven't seen enough of those guys to place them anywhere, or I think that there's not like a massive distinction yet that I've seen. So it's where I just lump everyone else that I kind of haven't gotten to yet. And obviously, as the draft gets closer, you know, that last tier that includes everybody else is going to get divided up more and more and more. I usually end up with 10 or 12 tiers, something like that. But today I only have 7 tiers for you and then the unranked tier 8, which includes everybody else. All right, let's get to it. Tier 1, Markelle Fultz. He's clearly the best prospect. I think the gap between him and the next players in the next tier, I think, is really, really sizable. There's not a lot in my mind that Fultz could do, I think, to injure his draft stock at this point. If you're listening to this podcast, you probably know a ton about him, and you've heard a lot about him. The only two concerns, I think, that I'd have and that I kind of hear out there are concerns about effort. Similarly linked are the is he a winner garbage critiques. The defense is definitely not where I've seen it in the past, definitely not where it was in FIBA play over this past summer. But I also think that he has every tool and instinct in the book, maybe besides a tiny bit of strength, which I think that he will add. And I would be pretty high on him at least becoming a slightly positive defender in the NBA during his prime years. And I assume that in those years also that he is his team's primary offensive creator and carrying a massive load on that end. So I don't think the defensive concerns are really all too much to be concerned about anyway. Other than that, he has every skill you could possibly ask for from a modern lead guard. He can finish, he can pass, he can shoot off the dribble, he can shoot off curls, pin down actions. He's probably, over the past 2 years, I think, behind only Towns as a prospect in my eyes.
And now, insurance-minded speeches from Geico.
It's a common expression, don't look a gift horse in the mouth. However, what if the horse's mouth is filled with useful insurance tools? This is the exact case with the Geico app. Yes, the app is free and therefore a gift horse. However, look inside the app and behold, emergency roadside assistance, digital ID cards, bill pay. Get the Geico app. Look it in the mouth. Get amazing services. Thank you.
All right, tier 2. I have Lonzo Ball, Josh Jackson, and Frank Ntilikina. Lonzo Ball is a really, really hard prospect for me to rank. I know a lot of people, especially nerdy draft people, have him in tier 1 with Markelle Fultz. For me, Ball has a very interesting skill set. He relies so much on intelligence and I think is able to mask a lot of his athletic deficiencies. He has an amazing two-foot vertical, which I think is probably a lot bigger than the rest of his athletic gifts would suggest that it should be. He's really long, obviously, for a ball handler, for a point guard. He's really long. He has great defensive instincts, but he lacks a lot of flexibility. He's a really stiff athlete. He rarely gets deep into the lane, which in the NBA is going to create a lot more passing lanes that he's going to be able to take advantage of. I think with the space of the NBA, he could look a lot better, but also he might not be able to get there. In pick and rolls, having the ability to start and stop the change of speed, which I don't think he has a ton of, is super crucial to creating space and to creating those really important passing lanes. if you simulate Lonzo Ball's career 1,000 times, I think that there are some outcomes in which he's the best player from this draft. And I think that there are a lot of outcomes in which he doesn't pan out at all. Obviously, there's a lot of situational uncertainty with him, depending on, you know, the context that he's playing in is going to mean a lot for him because he excels. We've seen him excel so much in a certain style, although I think that style is becoming more and more ubiquitous in the NBA. So maybe that's not that big of a concern. But the point, I guess, that I'm trying to make is that the 50th percentile outcome of those simulations of his career, I think, is kind of just maybe barely an all-star level player, maybe a little bit below. And that worries me. And I think maybe more importantly is that the spread of those outcomes, like the possibilities for his career, are really, really wide. I think Josh Jackson will probably be something. I think his career is very narrow. Like, the outcome in which he will be, I think, is fairly certain. Markelle Fultz, I think, is fairly certain. I think some of these other guys, it's pretty certain what they will be. Malik Monk, I think, is somebody who is pretty narrow window for what those simulated or, you know, expected value of his career might be. But for Lonzo Ball, for me, it's really, really spread. It depends on how bad his defense is at the next level. Or maybe he's a great defender, right, because of his instinctual play on that end. This is probably too much on Lonzo Ball, but I just wanted to explain that while I have him here in Tier 2, I could see him falling anywhere, maybe in these top 15 to top 20 players. I think that his skills are kind of masking a little bit of the athletic deficiencies that he has. And offensively, I'm not sure if that's going to absolutely kill him or if he's going to absolutely excel. And I could see it both ways. The next player is Josh Jackson. I think that very clearly he's in this tier. Some could argue that he's very clearly the second best prospect. I think for a while at the beginning of the season, I argued as much. Recently, his shot is coming on. I don't know how well that pushes him in either direction, because I think that it's broken enough, or at least it's got enough of a hitch, enough of a problem to where you don't want to project it getting too much better. His playmaking is good, but probably can never be a primary playmaker. Obviously, defensively, I think he's always going to give you a lot. His motor is very high. I think his intelligence is very high. There's a lot of versatility there. He just fits, I think, really well into a modern NBA where he can take advantage of creases that are already made for him. Ball movement style is going to be really important for him, where he's going to really excel. His handle is a lot tighter than I think people expected, especially his left hand. That's probably enough on Jackson. I think opinions about him won't change too much by the end of the year. The guy that a lot of people don't have here that I do is Frank Ntilikina. While that may surprise you, I think that you have to ask yourself about the value of a long point guard, defensive stud, who will be an all-NBA defender at that level, at that position, and probably has the versatility and length, like a 7-foot wingspan, to switch 1 through 3 for a long time in his career, is already unbelievably polished at that end. I think there's almost no way that he fails as a really, really, really high-level defender. And offensively, he shows tons of signs of being a really good shooter, probably a better spot-up shooter than he is off the dribble. I mean, well, I would say definitely that's the case. But last episode, like I talked about, he has a lot of problems in creating in the pick and roll. I talked about this with Jay-Z. Go back and listen to that one. It's a really good episode if you haven't already. I think that those problems can be corrected. He doesn't have great feel in that all-important kind of point guard situation for the NBA. But he does have really good instincts, I think, when there is set actions. When he's coming around a skirl off the baseline, immediately into a pick and roll on the wing with a big, he makes really good decisions out of that. Obviously, getting to the rim is another problem for him. Similar kind of to Lonzo, prefers to pass out of driving situations. I think that his length and his handle, which is tightening up, seems to me game by game, I think will eventually allow him to be a little more effective driving, and that he will be a big time plus on offense. The kind of fit that he can bring to almost any roster makes him so, so valuable. So while I don't think that he's ever going to be seen as an all-star or a lead creator, I think that he could be a second or third best player on a championship team because his fit is really, really amazing. The skill sets that he has allow for so many more options on the basketball court for both your defense and your offense. All right, tier three, I only have one guy, Jonathan Isaac. Normally, I don't have tiers this small this early, but I think it's just so clear. These top five prospects, I think there's a massive gap after that. Jonathan Isaac talked a lot about it in the last episode, amazing defensive prospect. I won't go on and on here. I think that he's surefire on that end, super, super versatile. Offensively, he'll be able, I think, to spot up, at least bring a little bit of gravity, although he may end up just being like a 35 to 36% shooter over his career. At that position, I think he's going to, you know, give you positive value on that end as well. And of course, I think like Ball, his range of outcomes is really wide. I think he could become much, much better than that. So if you're somebody that kind of likes that upside, I think Isaac, I think you'll understand why I have Isaac this high, if not kind of higher. Tier four, I have Dennis Smith Jr. and Jason Tatum. Dennis Smith Jr. on a lot of other boards is a lot higher than this. The more and more that I watch him, I think that he makes lots of little mistakes that aren't ever going to allow him to be a lead creator or the best player on a really good team. His passing just isn't crisp enough. His vision isn't there. He makes so many mistakes on defense, and it's not just about effort. While his motor is really, really bad, I think that there's a lot of little errors that he makes both on offense and on defense off the ball that really hurt his team. Obviously, the athleticism is there, and I think that he could even probably become more athletic. And I think that as he gets onto an NBA team with NBA trainers, an NBA diet, and further away from his ACL tear, I think that athleticism might show through a little bit more. But I think that he's always going to be kind of a me-first scorer with poor vision and a poor defensive motor, which really, really bothers me as an archetype. But I can't drop him any lower just because he could be a massively explosive scorer, which I think at this point in the draft, at number six, you know, is still really, really good for an eventual outcome. Next, I have Jason Tatum, somebody who I think has just slowly drifted down draft boards all season long. His defense was a big surprise. He uses his strength and his length so well. Just offensively, he hasn't been the kind of skilled scorer that everybody expected. He's shown flashes, but as far as efficiency goes, it's just not there. I still think that his three-point shot will come around. I think that his offense will come around, but it's not the sure thing that I think it was, or at least that I thought it was, coming into this season. Let's speed up a little bit here. Go into tier five. I have Malik Monk and Borisa Simanic. I know a lot of people will be surprised by that second name, but let's get to the first one here for a second. Malik Monk, I've watched a lot about him. My next episode with a really fun guest, we'll be talking about him in deep, deep detail. So I won't go into it too much here, but suffice it to say that he is, I think, a guaranteed knockdown shooter, somebody who's going to provide you space that's going to stretch defenses 4 feet, you know, kind of Houston Rockets style beyond the three-point line is going to be super, super valuable for an offense because he can do it in so many ways. His touch, his coordination on offense, not only in shooting off the catch, but off the dribble, I think he's kind of underrated in that area. Drifting in the paint, fadeaways at the elbow, he's just, I think he has it all. I think he's going to be able to, if a team has a good primary creator next to him that can get him in advantageous situations, I think he's going to be a very, very efficient jump shooter for his entire career. I think he shows flashes of good passing. His decision-making is kind of questionable, but it's definitely in that range where you're going to accept it. Defensively, I think there's probably more there to work with than he's given so far, and I kind of mean that in a positive way. I like Monk quite a bit for, I think, the one-dimensional player that he seems to be at Kentucky right now.
Together, we can make your blonde, blonde. Sheer Blonde Go Blonder Collection by John Frieda lightens and brightens hair 2 full shades to give you your best blonde every day.
Hair talks. Make your statement with Sheer Blonde Go Blonder Collection, only from John Frieda.
Borisa Simanic, somebody that I talked about in episode 15 with Bogdan Karadžić, and that I've watched a lot since then, he's somebody that has unbelievable physical gifts. That I think if you compared him against all of the players in this draft, I think behind Markelle Fultz, Jonathan Isaac, and Dennis Smith Jr., I think he's probably the fourth most physically an athletically gifted player in the draft, even over OG Anunoby, who I'll get to in the next tier. He's a 6'10 forward, definitely not a center, has to play the four, but he has very, very smooth handle. His pull-up from 3 feet behind the arc is so smooth, so quick, really deadly from there. I think driving, he's got a tighter handle than people think. Defensively, he's got super quick feet. Guarding on the perimeter, switching pick and rolls, even maybe 2 through 4 on small fours, I don't think it's going to be a problem for him. He's not getting a lot of love. Early in his career, he got a lot of hype, like Bogdan kind of mentioned in that episode. And he's starting to tail off because his production isn't there. He's not getting the kind of minutes that you would expect a prospect of his age and of his pedigree to kind of get after years and years of hype. But I still think that it's there. I think that if you get him in an NBA system with some space, with a defined role, I think he could be really, really good on both ends of the floor. He's kind of my go out on a limb pick here. I'm not trying to be contrary, but the more and more that I watch him, I just can't get out of my head. The physical gifts that he has and the coordination and the skill that he has to go along with it, I think is pretty incredible. So tier 6, I have Jared Allen, OG Anunoby, Miles Bridges, Rodion Krux, Lauri Markkanen, and Justin Patton. A lot of people might wonder why I have OG Anunoby and Lauri Markkanen so low. I think just the more and more that I watch both of those guys, I'm just not sure that they're going to be anything more than just like a one-dimensional type player. OG Anunoby, I think, can strictly only be a defensive prospect and doesn't really have the kind of motor or fluid athleticism or vertical explosion to be so valuable on defense that you put up with him as an absolute zero on offense. And then for Lauri Markkanen, obviously his shooting is near historic, probably historic for somebody his size. His shot is so amazing. I've been so high on him, and I want to put him higher, but there's just no way that he can play the five. He's going to have to play the four. There's a few scenarios in which he moves his feet kind of well, but on the defensive end, he's just going to be a bloody swimmer in shark-infested water. He's going to be put in pick and roll after pick and roll after pick and roll, and it's going to be devastating for that team's defense. He'd probably still be, I think, could be a positive-type player, but when you're playing good teams in the playoffs, I think that he may just be always a net negative, which is so unfortunate for somebody so skilled. I'm rooting for him. I'd love to see him do well, but I don't see him being able to hold it up on the defensive end in the NBA. Other than that, Jared Allen, a lot of people don't have him this high. He had a horrible beginning to the season at Texas, lately has come on. His physical gifts are such that I can't quit him yet. Really, really good standing reach. Huge, huge hands. I think there's still a lot there to be developed. He moves so well. I think that he's definitely worth taking a flyer on. Miles Bridges here, I think, makes a lot of sense. I don't need to go into him. Krux is somebody that I'll be talking about in a couple weeks, and I'm excited to do so with a really great guest. And then Justin Patton is somebody else that I'll be talking about really soon, so I won't go into too much depth with him, but the 7-footer out of Creighton, who's gotten a lot of buzz over the past month or so, somebody who on offense can both play the role man in the pick and roll, like kind of DeAndre Jordan, get up and put down alley-oops, and also be the pick and pop guy from three, as his jumper is really, really smooth and natural and has a lot to offer there. He moves really well on the perimeter for a 7-footer on the defensive end, although as a rebounder, as a shot blocker, I think he has a long way to go, both instinctually and strength-wise. The latter obviously can be improved. The former, I'm not sure how much people grow in that respect, although DeAndre Jordan has done that quite a bit. So we'll see. Tier 7, the last tier that I have ranked, I have De'Aaron Fox, somebody that I know a lot of people want me to have a lot higher than this. I think that his bad anticipation, below-average feel are just going to drag his ceiling down, even though he's really quick. I think he relies too much on being quick. And on defense, for somebody that has such a great motor and has kind of the mentality to, you know, guard you 94 feet, he gets burned an awful lot and makes a ton of mistakes. Like I said, his anticipation and feel for that kind of thing, as well as the offensive end, is just so bad that it neutralizes a little bit the physical gifts that he does have. And I think that really his passing isn't as much of a strength as people would like it to be. He takes advantage of the fact that Kentucky can play so well in tempo and not just breakaway fast breaks kind of things where he's lobbing it to Monk. But I mean, even in just when he's pushing it up the floor and they get open looks early in the shot clock because of a scrambling transition defense, I think that his passes aren't anything other than just kind of obvious good passes that are open because he's pushing it and because he's drawing double teams because he is so fast and can get around people. His finishing at the rim, I think, is really bad and has been since high school. I haven't seen any improvement in that area. Okay, this is enough probably on bashing on Fox, but just to say that I think he's very overrated and he has a long, long way to go. So if you want to take a gamble on that, I think, you know, whatever, I guess that's fine. I think he's still a first round prospect because of those gifts. But I think that the probability that he puts it all together, becomes a starting point guard in the NBA, is pretty low. And next, I have Terrence Ferguson, Juwan Evans, Harry Giles, and Robert Williams. Terrence Ferguson is somebody that I'm going to be talking about in the next couple weeks, so don't want to spoil that too much, but obviously there's a lot of unknown there because he's playing in the NBL, the Australian Basketball League, which, it's just kind of an unknown, and he's not doing terribly well over there. Like I said at the beginning, Harry Giles is here, if only because of the physical gifts that he has and that he's probably a lot better player than he's showing right now. And Robert Williams, somebody that's shown so many flashes but is so bad in so many other areas that I think he's probably becomes worth it as a gamble, as a lottery ticket here at this stage in the draft. And then in tier 8, I have everybody else. There are so many other players in that tier 8 that I have opinions on, but just haven't fully fleshed out my next tier yet. And of course, these are pretty fluid, and I expect things to change quite a bit before the end of the season. And I want to save some of these guys. I have a great guest coming up in a little bit, and we're going to talk about late first round, second round talents. We're going to talk about a lot of them. So a lot of those guys are in this tier 8, and I want to save that material for that great guest that I have coming up. The last thing that I want to talk about is the way the standings are shaping out right now. I'm going to use 538's projection and also the current standings to talk about this, but I think the two most interesting teams are the Lakers and the Kings. I've talked about both of them probably ad nauseum and why they're so interesting. If you want to know, you can go back and listen, but basically if the Lakers, you know, are able to keep their pick this year, then they don't have to give another first rounder to Orlando, which is super, super valuable. They have every motivation in the world. They're projected by 538 to finish with the fourth slot, which wouldn't be good for them because, you know, that's right at the place where they're going to give it up. And it would be very improbable that that they would pop up into the top three. Right now, they're sitting with the third pick, which I think gives them around a 44% chance of staying in that lottery and that pick protection area, which would obviously be great for them and not necessarily horrible for Philly, but would be a little bit disappointing considering the strength at the top of this class. Then the Kings pick, which is projected by 538 to land at the eighth spot, and right now they're sitting at the seventh spot. Of course, they have that pick swap with Philly, and they're only, I think, separated by a game or a game and a half. The most interesting thing when you look at the standings and you're trying to see maybe trends and where teams are going up and down, there's no clear pattern. For a little while, it seemed like the Pelicans may have been moving out of there. It seemed like Dallas was going to rock it up, and I guess they still could. It seemed like Minnesota was not going to be down in the morass for much longer. The defense seemed like it was improving. It was becoming, or at least getting closer to the Tibbs ideals on that end of the floor. But so many teams could really shut it down, resting stars, injuries, whatever it might be, that could gain a lot from just tanking here at the end. I think there's a clear distinction between the top five, maybe top seven players in this draft, and it would be super, super valuable if you could cement yourself there from Philly at number four through Dallas at the ninth spot. Currently, not projections, but currently how they sit in the standings now, they're only separated by two games. So, you know, those six teams, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9, separated by two games. So, you know, you go one of two ways. You could cement yourself and get a top five, top seven player who I think in this draft is pretty solid, or, you know, you could fight for that eighth seed, that all-important moral victory. So that's it for me. Hope you enjoyed this short episode where I re-ranked players. Please, please hit me up on Twitter. Email me all of your objections, all of the arguments that you have where I was wrong. You can follow me on Twitter at Ode2Odin. Email me at ode2odinpodcast@gmail.com. And as always, check out other podcasts on the Almighty Baller Podcast Network. There's so many hilarious hosts, so many good guests on this network. Just go to the website, scroll through a couple of your favorite teams, a couple of the most interesting teams in the league. And I think there's something for everybody. I think you'll definitely find a few that tickle your fancy. So again, that's it for me. Thanks for listening. Have a good one.
There is more to me, Queen Eliara of Elfgard, than my elven magic. Just as there's more to Geico than saving you money, Geico also gives you 24/7 access to licensed agents online, on the phone, or on the Geico app. And while I am a mighty elf queen, I am also a mighty big fan of barbecue potato chips. Minions! More smoky mesquite.
Geico. Expect great savings and a whole lot more.
And now, insurance-minded speeches from Geico.
It's a common expression, don't look a gift horse in the mouth. However, what if the horse's mouth is filled with useful insurance tools? This is the exact case with the Geico app. Yes, the app is free and therefore a gift horse. However, look inside the app and behold, emergency roadside assistance, digital ID cards, bill pay. Get the Geico app. Look it in the mouth. Get amazing services. Thank you.
Napa know-how.
The Napa guy knows not to judge a man by his car's multicolor paint job or absence of modern gadgetry. Who cares if it's technically old enough to vote and the windows are powered by the strength of your left arm? Your monthly payment is zero, and it'll stay that way. Because with over 500,000 parts and a little Napa know-how, you can keep anything on the road. She may not be pretty, but she's all yours. That's Napa know-how.
Napa know-how. Napa know-how.
A Napa guy knows the only way you'd give a fresh and minted driver a brand new car is if he promises to never drive it. Instead, let him grind the gears and knock over the neighbor's mailbox in something a little more suited to his skill level. And with over 500,000 parts and a little Napa know-how, he can safely drive something that's nearly as old as he is. It's not perfect, but it's perfect for him. That's Napa know-how.
Napa know-how.